America, I couldn't have sounded like this anywhere else.
Welcome to the Poetry Magazine podcast. I'm Fred Sasaki. This week we visit the opera. It is an absolute joy to be introducing this conversation between writer and musician Kevin Simmons and Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Anthony Davis. Simmons' new book, The Monster I Am Today, Leontine Price and a Life in Verse, skillfully travels through the life of one of classical music's greatest virtuosos. Leontine Price remains one of the 20th century's most revered opera singers, and she's the first black opera singer to achieve such international acclaim. Structured operatically into overture, acts, and postlude, I just love the complex layers of music history, biography, and the body itself that Simmons uncovers in this book. How do our bodies sound? Why do they sound that way? Here is Simmons' reading from The Monster I Am Today.
Dear, this wasn't no Chitlin circuit, not Ella's or Lena's crowd. This was box seats passed from one generation of Vanderbilts, Carnegies, Astors, and Guggenheims to the next. Dynasties with ledgers and holdings. Conquerors. I wasn't singing some slave strain collected with asterisk note. This is an approximation because the Negro never sang it the same or kept to key or rhythm. I mastered the fixed notes of Mozart, Puccini, Verdi, and Strauss. I had to kill their phantoms with poise and a swallowing silence. Do you hear? I had to clear my throat.
Simmons and composer Anthony Davis both share a deep gratitude for Leontine Price.
Every black singer reveres Price. She's the one who set the standard for everybody.
Davis has been making operas rooted in black history for over 30 years. X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, which was made in collaboration with his cousin, librettist, and writer, Thulani Davis, premiered in 1986. Today you'll hear from X and his opera Amistad, which revisits the story of the Middle Passage. Most recently, he premiered the Central Park Five, which won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize in Music. So, without further ado, here is Anthony Davis and Kevin Simmons discussing Black Sound, Black Church, and the future of opera.
With your work, the first time I heard it, it gave me a sense of being included in the music. I had never, ever felt that way when listening to an opera.
Wow.
Ever. I go to opera first because of the beauty and the authority of the sound of the voice. I had never gone for content. And with your work, the content and the beauty are at the same level. Can you talk a little bit about opera as a form for you and how you entered it and what it is you expect that form is able to accomplish?
Okay. I became interested in opera before I heard an opera. What happened is I lived in Italy for 10th grade. My father was teaching there as he had a Fulbright. So in the philosophy class, I was reading Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and, you know, the kind of roots of existentialism. And I read this book, Birth of Tragedy, that was about, you know, Nietzsche's concept of what opera is, what could potentially be. You know, the idea of the Dionysian and the Apollonian and all that stuff. I was fascinated by that idea. And I thought what he was describing wasn't German music, even though he thought he was writing about German music. What I thought he was writing about really was the potential of American music. The idea that we have the African in us, we also have the European in us, and that if someone could create an opera that was a synthesis of those things, it could be an amazing thing. So I began to think then, this was in 10th grade, I thought, well someday I'd like to write an opera. The next step was when my brother was, as an actor, it was in a play about Malcolm X, and he played the role of Malcolm X in the play. after the play, he came to me and he said, well, you know, you should write a musical about Malcolm X. I looked at him and I said, no, that's a tragic hero. He should be, it's an opera. It has to be an opera. Then I kind of discovered through looking at Malcolm X and working with my cousin Tulani, who wrote it, we began to think about creating an opera that would tell our story, our heroic story. Also because Malcolm was, you know, in the autobiography, he talks about music all the time. So in a way, our history is embedded in music. And when we did opened the New York City Opera in 1986, the house in Lincoln Center was unusual. It was every performance was sold out, and it was at least half African-American audience, which is, as you know, in Lincoln Center is completely really unusual. So I felt that we made a connection and that in telling these epic stories through music was something that was, I felt very natural and felt very, because the music's so much a part of our story.
You've also said that it allowed you to summon, and I think this quote is correct, you were able to summon all the rage in me.
Yes. Well, yeah, that was, that was very, very true.
And I don't know in the history of opera whether or not that is something that has been a generative reason for a lot of opera that's been written. Can you talk to me a little bit about what opera can do and the operatic voice can do that that musical theater and a musical theater voice can't do?
Soar. I mean, it's an out-of-body experience. It's from the body, but also there's a takeoff point, that visceral effect of hearing that sound, that voice that transcends the moment, you know, that in an aria, you can express the backstory of a character that you would never say in a play or never say in a movie. Opera is amazing because it also reveals the past as you reveal the present. And that's something that excites me because in a way, you're revealing the psychology of a character and also what made that moment. And what makes a moment sometimes is history makes the moment too. You know, oppression makes a moment. The violence against African-Americans makes a moment. You know, when Tulani wrote in Malcolm's aria, they had their foot on me, always pressing. I mean,
right.
I mean, when George Floyd happened, a friend of mine, he pointed out that line and said, well, you know, how did Tulani know?
Right.
Because unfortunately, we know it because this is a repeating story. This is recurring. This is something, and this is a motif. This is a leitmotif that we live with that's been there for, you know, since slavery. So it's something that's embedded in us that we confront. It's not just that it happens and it's and the horror of it, but it's also a reminder of the horror that has been there all along.
The operatic voice, it has this authoritative sound.
Power.
Power. And as you said earlier, it soars. And I gotta say too that you have been really blessed, so lucky to have somebody like Thomas Young.
Oh yeah, I love Thomas, yeah.
Whose voice, the first time I heard it, it just blew the top of my head off. And someone like Florence Quivar, like my God, these beautiful, beautiful singers whose voices are forces of nature. Call upon someone to perform music, there are certain things that have to already be in their body that they can call upon. And you've gotten really lucky and blessed to have these singers. Thomas, who has such facility in both operatic singing and in jazz, Florence Quivar, who also comes from the church. I mean, these are Black singers. There's something else that is brought to the stage that we seldom see.
Of course, yeah.
On opera stages.
I mean, with Thomas, it's like when I hear him sing, I also, because he's such a great jazz singer too, as well as being an opera singer who could sing a high D. You know, meaning him changed my life, you know, hearing him. When I remember when I was looking for an Elijah Muhammad, and so Thomas came to the audition, he sang Gounod's Faust, and he sang Daughter of the Regiment. I said, man, why are you here? Why aren't you at the Met? You know, what is going on, you know? And then he says to me, oh, I'm doing a gig at this club, you know, like tonight. I got my brother and I went to hear him sing. And he comes in and he's singing like Strayhorn and Ellington and all this stuff. And he does The Boat That's Leaving Soon in a way I've never heard anyone do. And there's a savagery about it that I never heard in any sport in life ever. He was one of the great jazz singers, like Ella Fitzgerald, great. Okay. And Florence had such an incredible instrument, and doing The Goddess of the Waters, telling the story of the Middle Passage, feeling her violation that she feels in the Middle Passage. I felt that when she said ripped from the land, she does that R and the ripped. Oh my God. I mean, it's like that moment of going up to that high D. She did, it's something that it's so operatic, but it also captures her rage at that moment, that rage about the violation that she feels.
So I may soothe them with my breath.
So what was interesting with the African-American singer, Black singers, is that they have this other experience that white singers don't have. I mean, it's singing in church, singing in the Black church. It's also singing jazz. Some of it, you know, nature of how they've had to work. You know, it's like they understand those characters. They understand what it feels like.
Oh, there's so many things to talk about. You've adapted this European form into something that's truly American. And that means that you have allowed jazz to inform this sound. One of the things that stand out most for me is how you often write for voices in a way that sounds very instrumental to
sure.
me.
Yeah.
You don't sound like a John Adams. You don't sound like a Stravinsky. You don't say I shouldn't say Stravinsky's. Well, what did Stravinsky become an American? I can't remember.
I think he did. Yeah.
He did become an American. But you know, I'm thinking about other American composers, a Copeland, Barber. The sound is very distinct. But I got to ask you this. What kind of church did you grow up in, or did you grow up in church at all?
My mother was an atheist. So, and she was a devout atheist. I mean, my father was kind of agnostic, but when I was little, I decided I had friends who were going to church. So I told him I wanted to go to Sunday school. So I did for a little while. I read the Bible, went through the whole thing, reading the Bible and all this stuff. So, but I have to say, I didn't really have a gospel background.
Right. Like, right.
That wasn't really my background.
Right. Yeah. And you said in the past that you knew going in that you couldn't draw on a gospel tradition.
No.
But that you could think about reinventing or rethinking about like Coltrane or Monk or, you know, these people who you love, Ellington and Mingus, which also for me is unique in your work, because you know how it is. In America, Black people are assigned certain sounds. There's a certain expectation of Black sound, be it in opera, as rare as that is, or in gospel or in musical theater, because people associate certain kinds of timbre or rhythm or moan to Black music. And I don't want to say that you don't have some of those sensibilities in your music, but to me, it's not readily identifiable. It sounds Black to me, but it doesn't rely on these tired tropes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting because your instrumental, like for example, when I did a chorus, Allahu Akbar, I had to be careful because I can't have people in the Nation of Islam sound like Baptists, you know, or Pentecostal people.
Right.
That's wrong. That's just wrong. I mean, so I had to kind of invent a choral form. So what I drew on was the way McCoy Tyner played piano, the pianist with Coltrane. So it has that modal thing. But behind it, I mean, the church is behind Coltrane too. I mean, so much, when you hear train, it has a church in it. I mean, definitely, you know, or,
right.
I mean, Coltrane was a huge influence in me. I mean, I used to live with those Love Supreme and those records, you know, but part of that is, it's a different kind of spirituality, like the spirituality that Coltrane was going for is kind of like where you're giving everything, you know, musically, it's like striving for something. I wanted to capture that, you know, particularly in X. Bing is also steeped in the church. I mean, Wednesday night prayer meeting or get in your soul, you know, all that stuff is so much for the church too. And Mingus's music was also a tremendous influence on me. Cause I like that visceral raw quality that Mingus had in his music. And I never quite could get the rawness that his music has. I mean, I always wanted to aspire to that. I mean, I think I naturally go to club. It's interesting. Sometimes how you develop your own voice is in the failed attempt to assimilate an influence, you know, that you find something else. And that certainly happened with me. But I think that I like the uplifting aspect of music. You know, music can take you out of where you are. And that's something you get in church, but also I think you get in jazz too, and can be in classical music as well. So I feel, you know, there's a way of taking people with you, you know, in the music.
I grew up in New Orleans and I grew up as an altar boy, so I didn't grow up in the traditional Black church either. And that meant that I had a lot of catching up to do when I got to high school and started singing in a choir for the first time. I had this operatic quality to my voice that I was kind of ashamed of in the beginning because I felt like it wasn't Black enough, you know?
So, yeah, I mean, I almost got in a fight with Steve Reich one time because, you know, Steve Reich was, he doesn't like vibrato and stuff, you know, so he said something about playing Porgy and Bess and he wanted to destroy the records. And I said, oh, no, no, you don't go, no. You know, you don't go there. You know.
Yeah, it's funny. As far as Steve Reich is concerned, one of my former voice teachers at Vanderbilt actually sang with his ensemble. And she said that when she went in for the audition, they wanted someone to sound like Joni Mitchell.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah, I would have had an argument with him, too, because vibrato is for me, it's timbre. And vibrato, those are the two things that most compel me about voices.
Oh, well, I was really nasty. I said to him, you know, that doesn't mean your music has to sound like the high lows. You know, it's like, whoa. I was really, you know, because I love the visceral, and I love the fact of the vibrato, and I love that. I mean, voices aren't just pitch machines. They're not that. And I always felt that was kind of a whiteness thing too, you know, this, you know, trying to strip the voice and make it this plain song thing, you know.
Right.
I always thought that's some aspect of whiteness that I couldn't stand. I mean, my wife watches American Idol sometimes and they have these singers that these Twinkie, I call them the Twinkie singers, and they just, there's no sound, and I can't. And they say, "Oh, there's such an individual." I don't. What are you talking about? And yet they'll give someone grief who has a actually has an instrument, a real instrument. So
right.
It's almost borders on kind of a racist thing.
Oh, I don't think it borders. I think that's what it is.
It's what
I experienced when I went to music school. It's like ballet dancers. It is a European art form and therefore has this long, very, very strict, codified process and history. And they believe that the body for a ballerina should look a certain way.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Like Misty Copeland had a face that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And oftentimes it's the same with singers. Singers, when I got to college, I had this, what I say was a big boned sound that really they wanted to train out of me in a way that they wanted that sound to heal, H-E-E-L. And so, you know, I wanted to listen to my teachers because my teachers were all white and I thought I wanted to become an opera singer. And I thought, well, I need to listen to these white people because they know what would allow me to get on a stage. But what it did was it made me sing in a way that was artificial.
Right. Sure.
And again, I told you, I didn't come out of the Black church. So I didn't show up to Vanderbilt with this gospel sound. I just came with a very full bodied, resonant sound that it was just in my body. From my mother and from just growing up in New Orleans, because, you know, I don't know, there's something in the water, there's something in the air. I struggled with that. And, I write a lot about that. So I think you're right. I also think it's hilarious that you call it a twinker sound because, you know, in gay queer parlance, a twink, you know, a twink is like a small, you know, a small guy. But anyway, you've troubled and irritated the art form. And you put Black people on the stage and you were doing it decades ago. And now we have the first African-American composer to have something being debuted at the Met.
Right, right.
Terrence Blanchard, it'll be later this year, I think. I don't wanna conflate the depth and expanse of his work, but it is a sound that is more familiar to people. And I don't think that the Met was, well, certainly it wasn't ready back in the 80s for you. And I don't think it's ready for you yet. When I say the Met, I'm talking about the management and I'm also talking about the subscribers,
right,
you know,
sure.
The people with the box yeah. seats and all of that. You know, A Porgy and Bess, which wasn't written by a Black person, but has an all Black cast, will run a line around the corner. I mean, people are going to be standing in line to hear that music because we've been conditioned in this country to have a certain expectation of Black sound, I think. And again, your music does blackness differently,
right,
in that
sure.
art form.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what do you think about that?
I mean, I'm excited because I think the door is ajar a little bit.
Just a little bit.
We'll see what happens in the future. But I think that all these companies went through a moment with George Floyd and with the idea that, you know, what they're presenting on stage and how it relates to the Black community. You know, they can't really afford to be an exclusive institution anymore. You know, that's affecting a lot of how symphony orchestras are functioning today, and opera companies are looking at that today. Hopefully that's not just a transient thing.
Right.
And I think that with the pandemic, with COVID and stuff, it gave them time to reflect, a year of reflection in which there was nothing really happening on stage. So you began to think about, okay, you know, what is the role of these institutions and how are they serving all the communities, you know?
Right. You know, I want to be careful about using the word relevance or timeliness because those are tricky words, but what do you think about the reception of the Central Park Five, your latest?
I guess there is a timeliness about it because, and I lived in New York at that time in 1989. I was in New York, so I remember seeing the images of them being led into a car, being led into the trial, and so it was very interesting to me. Also capturing that moment in 1989, you know, when it was almost as if it was a whole culture was on trial, the emergence of hip hop, you know, from the Bronx and coming to Manhattan.
Of course.
You know, the fact that when they said they were wilding in the park, that came from Wild Thing, the song. So I think, again, music was part of the story. And also 1989 was when Do the Right Thing came out.
Yeah.
And there were actually the white protesters who were calling for them, put these boys in, you know, have them strung up in Central Park, et cetera. You know, they had the placards and the placard said, Do the Right Thing, which is really weird because they were taking what Spike's.
I didn't know that.
So I remember the moment in the movie when Radio Raheem comes in with the boombox and into the pizza parlor, and Dan Aiello's character takes the bat and smashes mm-hmm. his boombox. So I felt that what this was is, in effect, they were putting Radio Raheem in prison.
Yes.
It was really about the, you know, this idea of when we see the gentrification of Harlem and all those big forces around that were happening at the time. And Trump was part of that, too, as a real estate person. So this violation of this woman and leading to the false accusations against these five young men was really part of this demonization of and wariness about how much hip hop culture had permeated. It was starting to become mainstream. That was interesting because sometimes you find that these political and these moments of fissure in our culture are also cultural moments, also musical moments too. I was drawn to that the way an Amistad. In 1839, 1840s was when the minstrel show started, was created. To me, it was no accident, because with the slave rebellions of Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey, mm-hmm. and then with the Amistad Rebellion, white America was frightened that slaves were going to rebel. There was going to be an uprising. So the idea of entertainment that shows, it gives you the myth of the happy slave.
Right.
That's something that they were craving.
That's right.
They needed.
They needed it.
They mm-hmm. needed it. And so that's something that when we were doing Amistad, when I was working with George Wolfe and Talani on it, you know, it was something we thought about a lot. You know, so there's these moments in the opera where, you know, how whites look at black people.
Mm-hmm. You just talked about how white folks needed the minstrel show. And we need, black people need, art forms that reflect us in a way that shows us how epic we are.
Right.
And how operatic we are, because we are. And I haven't been able to see Central Park 5 because it hasn't been performed that much so far. What is the reception? What's the reception been like for the opera? Of course, the opera won the Pulitzer.
It was, I had an amazing experience. I mean, we performed it in Long Beach.
I don't want to cut you off, but Long Beach, boy, they take chances.
They do. And I love the people in Long Beach. Yeah. It's an amazing company and they do take chances. And I have to say, also they did a lot of work with the community around Central Park 5. So for example, working with the ACLU and my cast of 5 got to meet the 5. And I did a lot of work with, we did meetings with the Innocence Project and a lot of meeting people who were falsely accused and incarcerated. For, you know, one man I met who was in a prison in Louisiana for 30 years for a crime he didn't commit. So they would come up to me and come to the show and come up to me and say, well, you know, do you know about the Sacramento 5, you know, 7? I mean, then you realize that this is not, you know, it's not, Central Park 5 was not unique. There have been so many people falsely accused of crimes in this country, particularly black people. So it comes to what's cathartic about art, you know, the idea that taking people through an experience that, in this case, some of them had even experienced themselves, and bringing them on the other side, you know, because of the end of the opera when they're exonerated. But also, I couldn't leave the opera like that. So we had a video of Tamir Rice, what happened with Tamir Rice at the end. So they all look at the monitors
right.
to see that, because
right.
it's something we have to watch. We always have to watch. We're on watch.
And because there's no pat ending.
No,
there can't be.
It can't be. And I wanted people to identify with the five, not look at them as these the other, not look at them as from a distance, but to feel what it's like to be them, right, or be a parent of one of them, you know, so to realize that their experience is our experience. And that's something you can do in opera, is that create that identification, create that sense of imagining yourself as that person.
Yes. What you've been doing for the last few decades is what we need to expand and to evolve opera. And I knew it back when I heard it in graduate school, and I know it today.
Well, thank you.
America, I couldn't have sounded like this anywhere else. Grooves cut down to bone, a terror, a reprieve. I constitute an order through sound men imagine but could never make. What you hear is an other matter, yes. Technique is ladder, but already the summit of my sound.
Big thanks to Kevin Simmons and Anthony Davis. Kevin Simmons is a writer and musician. His books include the hybrid poetry and essay collection, The Monster I Am Today, Leontine Price and A Life in Verse, and the poetry collection, The System Must Be Tried. He lives in San Francisco. You can read Dispatch from The Monster I Am Today in the April 2021 issue of Poetry, in print and online. Anthony Davis is a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer of operas, symphonies, and theater works. He is also a highly acclaimed free jazz pianist and leader of the ensemble Episteme, which he founded in the early 1980s. Today you heard from Davis's opera Amistad. A big thanks to New World Records for permission to include Act 2, Scene 6, the aria, They Come As If From the Heavens. You can find the whole album on the New World Records website. You also heard Malcolm's aria, You Want the Truth, But You Don't Want to Know, from the Opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. If you're enjoying the Poetry Magazine podcast, please let us know. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not yet a subscriber to the magazine, there's a special rate for podcast listeners. For a limited time, you can get a full year of the magazine for $20. That is 11 book-length issues for just $20. Visit poetrymagazine.org/podcast offer to subscribe. That's poetrymagazine.org/podcast offer. This show is produced by Rachel James. The music in this episode came from Irreversible Entanglements. Okay, that's it. Until next time, be well. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.